Good evening. It's nice to be here again among you. When people generally ask me at St. Louis, how long or when did you come or whatever that usually comes up, I said, with most people I can now say, before you were born. I'll leave it there. So the topic is spiritual rebirth, and it's in three parts. First, we'll look at spiritual rebirth in general and define it by distinguishing it from ordinary life. And second, we'll discuss spiritual rebirth with respect to scriptural text. And third, we'll look at the role spiritual rebirth plays in our interaction with the spiritual teacher. So spiritual rebirth is two words. Spiritual rebirth. We'll start with the second word, rebirth, which is in two parts, re and birth. And we'll start with the second part of the second word, birth, something easy. The natural birth, a baby is born, it cries when it breathes its first breaths and everyone else relaxes because the baby's healthy. Now, that's the natural state of things. Doesn't really require a definition. Now, when you put re in front of birth, then it gets interesting. Rebirth is reincarnation. The soul leaves the body when the body dies and is reborn, takes another body. The mind with its accumulated impressions, including the ego, the vital force, incipient sensory and motor function, leaves the body. And in course of time takes another physical body. Now, rebirth takes place after physical death. And the soul is not spirit. The soul is material. The soul is very subtle matter and very durable. What do I mean by very durable? We think of durable in terms of like the planet, lasts billions of years, the solar system, the galaxy, the universe. Well, the life of the universe is one day of Brahman. It's billions and billions of years. And the night of Brahma is the same length of time. And then it starts again with another creation cycle. And all the souls that are not liberated when the universe goes into cold storage in the night of Brahman, just go back into cold storage with all their accumulated impressions and come out of cold storage. So they outlast the universe, or they can outlast the universe. So it's extremely durable compared with gross matter. In contrast, spiritual rebirth takes place after the natural birth, while we're in the physical body, and while we're alive. What is spiritual rebirth? The common understanding, the conventional understanding, is that human beings are biological creatures. I reference to the physical body and one's mind in some combination, sometimes the mind more than the body, sometimes the body more than the mind, but in some combination. And this baseline common denominator natural understanding of I that accompanies our, you know, interpersonal communication does not include the soul. For most people, it does spiritually illumined people and avatars and Ishwara Kodis are a different class. I'm talking about the natural understanding. We may believe in the soul, but the soul is not part of most people's ordinary experience. It's not perceived through the senses, so it's not part of the natural understanding of what it is to be human. The natural understanding for most of us, most of the time, is that the I is the body-mind complex, the psychophysical system. Now, we have verbal testimony from reliable sources that's very close to its historicity. And, you know, in contrast to the normal understanding, we have things like Swami Premananda being very sick on his seemingly on his deathbed. His brother monks were concerned that it was his deathbed, and he is watching Yama trying to take his soul, very calmly describing what's happened. And he says, "Don't worry, I'm not going to die. When my mother gave me to the master and dedicated me to God, she said to Sri Ramakrishna, 'Does anyone give something for nothing?' He says, 'What do you want?' 'May I never suffer the bereavement of any of my children. Don't worry, my mother's still alive.'" But these things, the existence of the soul, we can accept it based on verbal testimony from reliable sources, you know, based on people that are established in truth in every other way. We can accept it, and it becomes part of our belief system, but not necessarily part of our experience. Now, suppose a person becomes aware through some unusual experience of the existence of the soul. Now, what could that be? We're in an extremely materialistic age. People are quite skeptical of things that can't be perceived through the senses or through instruments that expand the range of the senses. But one thing that the modern technology has done is it has increased the number of people who have what's called near-death experiences in controlled environments. In a general way, it has happened many times in a hospital setting. Someone's in an operating theater and getting surgery, and for some reason their heart stops. And it stopped for some time, sometimes quite a long time, and the medical team is often able to revive that person. And sometimes when they're revived, when they come to in the step-down room or the recovery room or the intensive care unit, without having talked to anyone, when they first regain consciousness, they're able to narrate exactly what happened in the operating room while their heart was stopped and their brain waves were flat. Who was there? Who said what to whom? Where they were? And also a very keen understanding of the feeling states, not only the observable facts, what one can see and hear, but the feeling states, whether someone's excited or what their mood was, of all the people in the operating theater. And you can dismiss it if it happens once or twice, but it happens dozens and dozens and dozens of times in these controlled environments. It's no longer dismissible. And the scientific reaction at first was, well, it can't happen because nothing we know says that it could happen. Well, it just reverses things. Science starts with facts and then theories, and theories shouldn't expunge facts. So now there's some interest in seeing what exactly is going on. So this is an indirect evidence of the existence of the soul. Often, what happens is the body's on the operating table, and the person that's aware of what's going on in this room is at a different vantage point, looking down at the body and not identified with the body. I'm here, the body's there. Subjective ego consciousness continues. Seeing here continues. Hearing continues. Mentation continues. And whether the body dies really isn't significant to that entity at that time. And what happens is at some point during this experience, subjectively for that soul, they remember some loved one, a spouse or children, and all of a sudden, whoosh, you know, the near-death experience ends, and the next thing they know, they're waking up in some hospital setting. Now, these sorts of things also have occurred in the ancient literature. There's lots of records of them. But the frequency and the nature of them, sometimes, occasionally, this happened at least once, that someone that was in the operating theater would say, "I don't know what I did with such and such." And the person that was dead at that time. Their brain waves were flat. Their heart was not working. Said, oh, you put that in that little cart that holds all the surgical instruments, top shelf, left-hand side. So it happens. Now, so all the elements of the subtle body are there. The mind, the ego, the incipient sensory and motor function, continuous subjective consciousness. Now, does this near-death experience constitute spiritual rebirth? It can be transformative. It can change people and how they view themselves and how they view their lives. And I've known people to whom this has happened, that it has changed and the change has been permanent. But it's not a spiritual experience. It's extrasensory, but it's not spiritual. One becomes aware of the soul as an entity separate from the body, but the soul, of which the mind is the principal component, is still very subtle matter, very durable, but matter. So it gives us a broader understanding of what it means to be human. In the near-death experience, for the people having it, the body consciousness diminishes, and the body identification diminishes to almost zero, but the identification switches almost wholly to the mind. So what is spiritual rebirth? Well, what is spirit? Vedanta, especially Advaita, non-dualistic Vedanta, is crystal clear about what spirit is. Spirit is the consciousness in each of us that knows the external world. It knows the existence and certifies the existence of everything that we do know. It knows the external world, knows the boundaries of the body. It knows the internal states of the body. It knows the states of waking, dream, and deep sleep, and it knows the mind in its various phases. Consciousness is spirit. The knowing entity in each of us is spirit, and everything known is matter, even the mind. So, to kind of pull this together, think of life as a string of beads. The first bead is birth, and then we have one experience after another. We're hungry, we're thirsty, we're happy, we're sad. There's a beautiful sunset. We get up in the morning. We have our day. Each experience is a bead that's put on that necklace. It is our awareness that connects the experience. It's continuous. It's the string that connects those experiences. We're little children. We grow up. We're adults. We become parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. And there's a continuity that connects those different people with different ideas and experiences. The continuity is the string that runs between the experiences. Sri Krishna says, all is strung on me as a necklace on a thread. And sometimes the threads are nice and continuous, and sometimes they wind up in circles and spirals and have all these knotty problems. You know, the necklace gets tied in knots and all these interesting experiences. But no matter what it is, that string, that consciousness, that impersonal, uncreated, divine awareness, which is also love, is throughout that. And if you look at a very fine pearl necklace very carefully, you can see that there's something between the pearls, you see. And spiritual rebirth is waking up to the thread that connects our experience somehow or other. There's this dichotomy in human life as analyzed from the perspective of Vedanta. On the one hand, there's the Atman, that witness consciousness, that loving consciousness internal. The real man, the real woman, the real child, birthless, without death, pure, free, and immortal. Beyond all change, the repository of infinite love and bliss. The repository of infinite consciousness. It's always there, prompting us to unselfishness, because that witness consciousness isn't the same in all of us. Though for the most part, we're not aware of that prompting, but it's there in the background. Now, on the other hand, as psychophysical beings, we're conditioned, subject to birth, death, disease, seeking limited happiness related to the conditioning of our minds and bodies, and often at the expense of others, knowingly and unknowingly. Now, the test of truth, both relative and absolute, is non-contradiction. We have a provisional understanding, and then experience shows us that it's not true. Experience contradicts that understanding. Eventually, through long experience, we wake up to this larger dimension of being human. We somehow see the string connecting our experiences. This may come as the awareness of that witness consciousness, the Atman, or our awareness of our relationship with the divine in some kind of the divine with qualities, seeing the Murti of God, seeing the form of God, and feeling concomitant with that, getting a taste for the infinite through that, and an awareness that there's this larger dimension. The person fully established in the Atman, or in the divine relationship with God, is liberated, free, illumined. And the first undisputed awareness of spirit is what we're calling spiritual rebirth. It begins in a very small degree with just a little consciousness of our relationship with the divinity, or just a little awareness of that immortal spiritual self, the Atman. Then, just as an acorn grows into a large tree, or a bit of yeast leavens many measures of flour, similarly, a little bit of spiritual sense grows within us through spiritual discipline until it shines forth as complete God realization. Spiritual rebirth is something that actually happens to us. It is an experience with great potency for change. A little taste of the joy of Satchit-Ananda comes into our lives as an experience different from any other, and draws us on for that joy that's infinite, for ultimate fulfillment. Now, the scriptural text that we'll take is from the New Testament, from the Gospel according to St. John, chapter 3, the first verses. Now, you might say, why take something from the New Testament? When Swami Vivekananda was in Thousand Island Park with his American students, he said, anyone who makes that long trip to Thousand Island Park, I'll consider my disciple, my special student, and I'll teach you. I'll try to teach you whatever I know. And he said that was his most productive time in the West. And one of the things that was recorded, he said, if all the scriptures of the world were somehow lost, and the only thing that remained was Christ's statement, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, that would be enough for the salvation of humanity. I mentioned this to Father Francis Clooney when he was visiting us once, and he said, I want to see the quotation on that. And I showed it to him. And he said, I don't think we can go that far. He says, what Vivekananda is saying is that other scriptures, other than the Vedas, are Veda. have that potency, an equal potency, and it's what Thakur said, to take us to the highest realization. So in that sense, and with that spirit, let's look at this short text, this short conversation. Now there was a Pharisee, a man named Nicodemus, who was a member of the Jewish ruling council, the Sanhedrin. He came to Jesus at night and said, "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher who has come from God. For no one could perform the miracles that you are doing if God were not with him." And Jesus replied, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, no one can enter the kingdom of God unless they be born again." And Nicodemus replied, "How can someone be born when they are old? Surely they cannot enter a second time into their mother's womb to be born." This is the common understanding of birth. And Jesus said, "Verily, verily, I tell you, no one can enter the kingdom of God unless they are born of water and of spirit. Flesh gives birth to flesh, but the spirit gives birth to spirit. And you should not be surprised at my saying, you must be born again. For the wind blows wherever it pleases. You hear its sound, but you cannot tell where it comes from or where it is going. So it is with everyone born of the spirit." He's describing a liberated soul there at the end. So let's go through this. Nicodemus was a master of Israel. He was on the ruling council. The Jewish ruling council was it wasn't a secular state, it was a religious state. And the Sanhedrin made decisions not only on religious matters, but on secular matters. And he was the only member of the Sanhedrin that we know of that accepted Jesus. And he came at night because it was not at all politically correct for him as a member of the Sanhedrin to associate himself with Jesus, and even less appropriate for him to tell Jesus that he was genuine. So it was more than a little brave for this man to come and to tell him those things. And it must have been important for him to do that, or he wouldn't have taken the risk that he did in coming, the risk for his position, his prestige, his power, everything that he'd worked for in his life could just go down the drain if this became common knowledge. And Christ's response to Nicodemus' courageous personal statement, "You're genuine, I recognize you," was startlingly abrupt. "I tell you, no one can enter the kingdom of God unless they are born again." Now, contraposed to that, we've got these conversations in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, the conversations with these big people in society, Vidyasagar, Pandit Shashadar. And I think Pandit Shashadar is more similar to Nicodemus than the other conversations, because he was a religious teacher. He was a pundit. And His spiritual consciousness was waking up. And in this way, it's similar. But the conversation went on for hours. And generally, when Sri Ramakrishna entered into conversation or dialogue with a big person, it started off rather innocuously. He said, "Oh, what do you think about this? And what do you think about that?" And he'd get them comfortable with him. And then at some point, the master would go into samadhi, or he'd start talking about the nature of Atman and Brahman and Shakti, and he'd give these illustrations, and he'd sing songs. And Vidyasagar, who was so learned that most people, when they came into his company, they'd start to tell him something, "I know that, you don't have to say anything," sat there spellbound for about 6 hours, kept saying, "I've learned something today, I've learned something today." But generally what happens is that towards the end of that long conversation, that long dialogue, which has become a monologue for the most part, Thakur enters back into dialogue with this person at the end. And in that dialogue, he says, he zeroes in on that person. And he says, this is where you stand. Not in a gross way, in a subtle way. The person has to have some subtle understanding in order to get the import of it, but they do. This is where you stand, personally. This is where you are, and this is what you need to do next, okay? But in this conversation, if we can compare it with Sri Ramakrishna, Christ is jumping from, hi, how are you, to this is what you need to do next. This is where you are. There's nothing in between that we have. So my guess is that we're missing some of the intervening conversation, that it probably wasn't this fast. But M wasn't there, you know? We had someone there, but it wasn't him. I tell you, no one can enter the kingdom of God unless they be born again. Now, the kingdom of God is used in different senses by Jesus. And the common understanding of the kingdom of God is that the Messiah, God incarnate, would come and create heaven on earth, a millennium, a perfect world. And this was a more common understanding. And sometimes he seems to be using the kingdom of God in this way. Christ does. And there's another meaning. The kingdom of God can mean the kingdom of heaven where the righteous go after death, which was also a belief at that time. And the third meaning, which Christ used, and in this case he seems to be using, is God realization, the immediate perception of God that is liberating, as this is how we understand it. He says, in another place, he says, the kingdom of God cometh not with observation, lo here and lo there. Behold, the kingdom of God is within you. Does not come through sensory observation. It doesn't come through ordinary means. It's a different entity. Rare is the wise person who, turning his thoughts or her thoughts inward, meditates on that divine being and realizes the truth. So he's jumping, says, Nicodemus, hey, wake up. You've got everything you need in this world. You need to realize God. And then Nicodemus comes back with his comment. Yet, how can you be born again? How can you go back into the mother's womb when you're big? It doesn't work that way. But Christ just hammers again. And you see, this Pandit Shashadhar actually followed Ramakrishna's advice. He went into seclusion. He quit talking and making all this noise. And he practiced spiritual disciplines. This is what Thakur told him he needed to do. He did that. And this also worked with Nicodemus. There were two men that took Christ's body and prepared it for burial after his crucifixion. One of them was Nicodemus. And he brought 70 pounds of myrrh, which is a very expensive spice. And he brought that with him. And he wasn't afraid anymore for anyone to know of his association, that he thought Christ was genuine. So Christ answers the second time, I tell you, no one can enter the kingdom of God unless they are born of water and spirit. And the question is, what is water? Well, there's the baptism, where you get dunked or sprinkled. But what does it mean? What's the meaning? What is Christ talking about? Well, one interpretation that makes sense to me is he's talking about our purifying thoughts. One has to go through some purifying, some mental cleansing in order to be born on the spiritual level. Blessed are the pure, if you connect this statement, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. How do you get pure in heart? Is it accidental? Does it just happen? Or do you have to work at it? Our way of expressing it would be dharma. You have to practice dharma. in order to rise to the spiritual level. The Mahabharata says the one universal duty of all human beings is the practice of Dharma. And it's continuous. It can be practiced at any level. It's continuous before and after spiritual rebirth. It doesn't stop. The expert dancer doesn't take a wrong step. They don't need to be so concerned about practicing Dharma because they're established in the truth. They're established in that divine center, which is the reason for Dharma, the reason why Dharma works for us. They're established in the knowledge that all people are connected at the spiritual level, that Atman is universal, and it's not different than any, but that's the essence, that loving consciousness is the basis. It's the metaphysical truth that supports Dharma. It's not just a convention. It's the way metaphysical truth acts on a social and interpersonal level. You know, we have the freedom to practice adharma. We have the freedom to cultivate anger, jealousy, hatred, and pride. We have the freedom, with respect to natural laws, to do stupid things, you know? Gravity acts the same on all of us. You know, whether we know the law of gravitation or not, it's there. It affects all of us in the same way. And we have the freedom to be stupid with respect to gravity. We can jump off a high place onto a hard object, that there are consequences. Similarly, there are consequences for adharma, and there are consequences for dharma. Dharma purifies the mind. It clarifies the intellect. It reduces conflict within our own minds. It reduces conflict with the people that we interact with. And it gives us the wherewithal to utilize whatever resources we happen to have in the best manner that we can at any time. And we can always do better with it. We can always do better with it. It's not something that just stops at a certain time and you says, well, I've done that. After realization, but okay, all right, if we're still in the body, in most cases. So let's go back to Nicodemus. He's a master of Israel. He's wealthy. He's respected. His spiritual sense is waking up, and it's being quickened by this interaction with Jesus. You know, we forget that we read these dialogues that people had with Christ and Ramakrishna and Buddha. We forget what kind of personal integrity it takes to stand toe-to-toe with an avatar and have a conversation. These were really strong people. And being in that physical proximity and having that divine consciousness focused on you like that changes people. You know, by the end of the conversation, somehow or other, they're different people. So this spiritual sense, you know, it's possible to be religious without being spiritual, to be pious, to believe the teachings, to associate with religious people, to say the prayers, but to do this for wealth or pleasure or succeeding in life. And it's also possible to be spiritual without being religious. See, it's possible to be spiritual without being religious. And we find that the great teachers all saved seemingly rotten people, you know. It's like they decided to put their worst part out so everyone could see and hide their best part. But a truly spiritual teacher can see beneath the surface of the mind, beneath the external behavior. And they know all the samskaras and how to wake them up and who to interact with and how. So how does one become awakened to the spirit? People see the condition in this relative existence, that the best is not sufficient, and that you can't go beyond the polarities that define our experience. Life and death, health and disease, happiness and misery, joy and sorrow. they're inextricably connected. And as you know, Swamiji has example, the pendulum. If life is a pendulum and one side is happiness and the other side is misery, we want to hold the pendulum over here exclusively. But as long as we hold on to life, the pendulum must swing. We get both. So at some point, this dream breaks that we can really get what we want from ordinary experience. And just to illustrate this, I was on a pastoral visit some years ago in the hospital after an elderly lady had back surgery. And her surgeon came in with his orthopedic resident and his orthopedic nurse. And while they were busy taking the dressing off the patient so that he could look at it, he was kind of just didn't have anything to do. He was saying, well, you know, the new tape that they have for these surgical dressings is really, really good. And because it sticks so well, it's really reduced the post-surgical infection rate a great deal. And we're very excited about it. He said, the problem is that, especially with older people, and I'm watching these two big guys with this little lady at you know, working to try to get this dressing off her very carefully, very slowly. He says, is that with older people that have kind of thin skin, sometimes you can't take the tape off carefully enough and you damage the skin and then you have another problem to deal with. And he says, the good thing about this tape is that it sticks really well. And the bad thing about this tape is it sticks really well. Now, I've been around him quite a bit by this time. He's a self-admitted perfectionist and one of the really good spine surgeons in the country. And every time I was around him, he'd throw off a little remark like this. This guy has been paying attention, you know? He said, the reason that I do these surgeries with older people is because of Sister Mary Louise. He's Catholic. And you usually don't take risks with people that are over 80. And he said, well, she said, you know, doctor, she said, I'm going to live whether I have this spine pain or not. Can't you do something in the interim? And he said, well, I don't know. I said, and they talked a little bit. She says, look, she says, doctor, she says, you do this surgery, I'll pray for you. Every nun in my convent's going to pray for you. He says, okay, let's go ahead. She turned out okay. So then he turned a page and he started doing it with older people. So through observation, and it's helpful if we're very sincere about what we're doing on the mundane level, that we're very sincere and we put our minds and hearts into it, and we not only do our job, but we're serving people, whatever we're doing, directly or indirectly, we're serving others. But through observation, through one's own experience, one becomes eventually convinced more or less that there's nothing dependable in this world, there's nothing independent in this world, and nothing less than that will completely satisfy it. And this yearning for something more is what takes us to that experience, that spiritual awakening. And this leads us up to karma yoga. Up until the point when we have spiritual rebirth, we're really not doing karma yoga. But that there's a change there. When the self-understanding changes from being a body-mind complex, a biological being, to a spiritual being with a body-mind adjunct, then the attention shifts from the temporary to the eternal. And the secular values shift from being ultimate to proximate goals. How will this particular thing help or hinder my ultimate goal, which is to be able to sit down every morning in my spiritual practice and have my mind calm so that I can get some connection with my Ishta? This begins to guide our lives. In traditional Hindu terms, the goal shifts from wealth and pleasure, from artha and kama to moksha. And the practice of dharma, this purifying thing that Christ is talking about, that's symbolized by water, is continuous up to karma yoga and after karma yoga. And it requires a great deal of self-effort on the part of the spiritual seeker, because when we wake up to the existence of the spiritual dimension, we're consciously trying to purify ourselves. We have some idea of what we're doing. And this requires a great deal of self-effort. And along with that comes divine grace. And that's the role of the spiritual teacher. The role of the spiritual teacher is to put a person on the right track so that the mind does not waver. Sri Ramakrishna says, if we move one step towards God, God moves 10 steps. So to the extent that we're trying, that grace must come. And it's the effort that we make that allows us the insight to recognize help when it comes, to recognize the spiritual teacher that's going to help us. And when we recognize them, sometimes they recognize you first, and you only catch on later. I remember a story, this happened to one of our devotees in California, who's a disciple of Swami Prabhavananda. And he went to visit his mother in Portland and said, oh, there's this wonderful Swami here, you gotta go see him. And she had no interest in all this stuff. But, you know, he managed to convince her to come along. And they listened to this Sunday talk by Swami Aseshanandaji. And as they were going out, he said to his mom, Mom, how did you like it? She says, I didn't like it at all. And that was the end of it. Now, sometime later, his mom calls him up all excited. I don't remember the time frame, 6 months, a year, year and a half, some time frame like that. And she says, I just want to tell you, I just got initiated by Swami Aseshananda this morning. He said, what? I thought you didn't like Swami Aseshananda. He says, well, yeah, I know. I went out of there and I didn't like it. And I didn't like what he said and I didn't like him and I didn't like anything about it. But I just couldn't get him out of my mind. I just couldn't get him out of my mind. So I went back and then I kept going back. And then it started to seem okay. And then, well, I just thought you'd be happy to know I just got initiated. So the spiritual teacher may recognize you and may bless you and may pray for your welfare without you ever knowing it consciously. But eventually, hopefully, we figure it out. We're eligible for spiritual initiation, and usually this is mantra initiation. As soon as we rise to the spiritual level, as soon as we have that initial experience, that first glimmer of that divine nature, it doesn't mean that we're going to get help, that kind of help, immediately. It might be years afterwards when that help comes. It varies a lot from person to person. Sometimes the help comes through a mantra. Sometimes the spiritual teacher can give experience through a wish, a touch, or a glance. And we see that in the lives of the great spiritual teachers. Now, you might ask, we're in the internet age. Why not just Google it? You can get a lot. I mean, I've talked to people. It's what do I need it for? You know, why do I need that? Well, God is the most subtle reality. And if we're really sincere and we really try to do everything we can ourselves, we soon realize what our limitations are. And that's another reason to find help. You know, and there's another aspect to it. So you can find someone really good on the internet. There's an old kind of a riddle, Sanskrit. If you're a Sanskrit teacher, what do you need to know in order to teach Gopal Sanskrit? Gopal being the name of a boy. Well, if you want to teach Gopal Sanskrit, you need to know Gopal. Knowing Sanskrit is not going to do it. You need to know Gopal, who he is, what his hang-ups are, what his intellectual capacity is, what his interest is, what his attention span is, and how to get him hooked on Sanskrit so he's interested. Google doesn't know who you are. spiritual teacher does. So I want to give a few examples of how this works. Sri Ramakrishna, there are many wonderful examples in his life, but one of them where he we kind of take it with a grain of salt when his monastic disciples have these wonderful experiences with him, when the world disappears and they have all these insights immediately and all that. But as with other great teachers, Sri Ramakrishna saved a lot of rotten people. And one of those seemingly rotten people was Kalipada Ghosh. He was a very capable man, very strong man, the manager of a British firm. He drank heavily, and although he earned a good salary, there was not much left for the household maintenance after he'd finished spending it on his proclivities. There was a tendency at that time to imitate the worst aspects of Western culture, and he was doing that. And he used to tyrannize his wife, who Vishnupriya, I think, was her name. And she's a very noble woman, naturally inclined towards God. And she was at her wit's end as to what to do. And somehow or other, she got the idea to go to Sri Ramakrishna, go to this holy man at Dakshineswar and ask for help. So she went to Sri Ramakrishna, and she told him her plight. And he says, oh, go to that lady in the concert tower. She'll help you. So she found Holy Mother and told her her plight. And she said, oh, no, you go to... You go to the gentleman over there that sent you here. You go to him. So after she went back and forth three times, Holy Mother finally decided that, the master really wanted her to do this. So she gave her a sacred leaf and a mantra. And she said, repeat this mantra sincerely. And I believe it'll help. It'll change your husband. So she did this. She practiced that Holy Mother's instruction sincerely, but she didn't see much change in Kalipada's life. Still, she didn't stop. About 3 years passed, and one day Kalipada decided, or Girish Ghosh decided, they were friends, to go to Dakshineswar. He came with Girish Chandra Ghosh, and the room was filled with people. Kalipada sat on the floor and was listening to what Sri Ramakrishna said, when all of a sudden he got up. Ramakrishna said, well, he said, sit down, Ashut. No, I've heard all these things, all this talk about God. I can also talk about God. Anyone can talk about God. Sit down. No, I want a drink. Ramakrishna said, get him some water. Get him a drink of water. No, I don't want water. I want a real drink. Ramakrishna says, a real drink. Ah, acha. All right, we'll give you a real drink. Sit down. Kalipada thought Ramakrishna might give him some country-made wine and didn't like that. So he said, no, he said, I don't want that country-made wine that you want to give me. I want a real drink. I want British whiskey. You see how forthright he is. He's not hiding anything. And how strong he is. All right, sit down. The home brew we have here is very strong. Not everyone can stand it. That got his interest. And also, you see, this is the dynamic. This is the dynamic with a personality like Sri Ramakrishna or like Jesus. Even the strongest person is influenced as they stay in that sphere with them. you know. Thakur wanted him to sit down. He sat down. Not everyone can stand it. Sit down. What Sri Ramakrishna did was he moved towards him and touched him. First he touched his head, his chest, and then he touched his head. And as soon as he was touched, Kalipada started sobbing. The man was sobbing uncontrollably. Tears were running down his cheeks. The man who never cried for anyone. Every hair on his body stood on end, and he couldn't stop crying. This changed him permanently. He was not the same person after that. And he was still kind of a roughneck. He got Thakur somehow out in a boat on the river, and they were alone. And he said, you know, when the time of death comes, he says, no one is going to be there for me, not my wife, not my kids. He says, you know what a rascal I am. He said, I want you to promise that when I die, you'll take me by the hand and lead me and lead my soul out of the body. And Thakur said, don't worry, don't worry. And he wouldn't let him go. Thakur promised. And on his deathbed, as he was dying, he said, Thakur has come. And he raised his right arm as he died. Now, you might say, well, okay, that's nice. That happened a long time ago. But now we just get mantra initiation and, you know, sometimes we get it in big groups and, you know, we don't have that kind of personal touch. So I want to tell something a little more recent that's in our tradition. On the way to the St. Petersburg retreat in Tennessee, for the last few years we've been stopping with a devotee couple. And this is something that she narrated the first time we went there. It was after they had started living in the United States, and they'd go back every year and stay with relatives. They'd go together, and then she wasn't working, so she'd stay on longer, and her husband would come back to the States. And for some reason or other, this was 1985, she had this unbelievably strong urge to see Swami Virashwaranandaji, who was president of the order at that time. It was just almost uncontrollable. The problem was, this was 3 months before his death. He had throat cancer, and people were not allowed to see him. So she'd go again and again to Bellarmont, and every time his attendants would say no, no one could see him. But she just kept coming back like a boomerang. And she couldn't understand what was going on. And now, she's not an easy person, very capable person. She was in the Indian Foreign Service. In the 1940s, she was Nehru's secretary, and she was there at the time that he received the news that Gandhi was assassinated. So she was able to narrate, you know, this is what Nehru said, this is what he looked like, this is how he... she was able to kind of give a word picture for the whole scene. And she's not an easy person to say no to. Very sweet, motherly woman, but very strong. So finally it was decided that he'd initiated thousands and thousands of people, and they all wanted to see him, that they'd let the general public see Swami Virashwaranandaji. And they did it in this way. People queued up, thousands of people, and he was in this room, and there was a barricade so that no one go up and touch his feet. But they had to, you know, make their pranams from a distance. But they could at least see him, and they rushed everyone through, and Momota got in line with everyone else, and she went through, and she had, you know, she saw him, so she was okay. And afterwards, she was with some of her relatives, and they were just chatting. And one of the attendants that she'd come to know quite well, because he was one of them that always told her she couldn't see Maharaj, came up to the group and said, Swami Virashwaranandaji wants to see you. And her brother-in-law is very close to the order and still had that access to him. So she said, Bolanath, Maharaj wants to see you. And the attendant says, no, he wants to see you. So he took her to see Swami Virashwaranandaji. He was still in the same room, but everyone had left, and then the attendant left. And they're alone. And Swami Virashwanaji says, what do you want? That's always a hard question. What do you want? Maharaj, I just wanted to see you and I've seen you. What do you want? I just wanted to see you, Maharaj. That's enough. Do you repeat the name of Sri Ramakrishna? I repeat his name all the time. Come closer. She comes closer. It wasn't close enough. He says, come right up here next to me. And she does. And he says, touch my knee. And she does. And then he said, bend your head down. And as she does that, he takes both hands and puts them on her head. And as she's talking, she's reliving this experience. And her face lights up and she says, I can't tell you what happened. But when I came out of the room, I felt I had the whole world in my hands. And I still feel it. And then she breaks out of her narration and she says, I love everybody. I love my neighbors. We're in the suburbs of a small Tennessee town. We're the only people from India in this neighborhood. And I love my neighbors. They're all my children. You see, if you didn't go through the mantra, but she got something that established her both in her spiritual relationship with her ishta, with her chosen ideal, and in her relationship with other human beings. They're all my children. She points to a picture on the wall. It's one of her neighbors dressed up as Santa Claus at Christmas. That's Richard, she said. His mother died 10 years ago. And 6 months after she died, he came to me and he said, may I call you mother? Of course you can call me mother. I want you to call me mother. I am your mother. She said, they take care of us. I don't feel any lack here. I don't feel like I'm a foreigner here. And then she goes back into her narration. The story's not over. You know, she's got all this agitation, you know, about seeing Swami Virashwarananda. Her husband's back at home, and he's thinking, my God, she's getting to be an old lady, and she hasn't had initiation yet. So he contacts his brother, and he says, Bolanath, Swami Virashwarananda isn't seeing people. Can you talk to Swami Bhuteshananda and see if he'll initiate my wife? So it was arranged, and she went to see Swami Bhuteshananda, after all this had happened. And when they met, Swami Bhuteshanandaji asked her, he was a vice president at that time, have you been initiated? No. Have you had mantra diksha? Have you been given the mantra? No. I will initiate you. And then somehow, this subject came up, and she told him what had just happened to her with Swami Virashwarananda. And then Swami Bhuteshanandaji said, you don't need mantra diksha. You don't need this kind of initiation. The connection with your ishta, with your chosen ideal of God, has already been made. So it's not, the world is never without illumined souls. And these things still happen. It's part of the human condition. And we're very fortunate, you know, that we have so many evolved people in our own movement, in our own religious order. So to pull it all together, let's go back to Christ. Christ says you must be born of spirit. When a person recognizes the spiritual self, he or she knows that spirit belongs not to this physical universe, but to the supreme spirit, the supreme self, the Paramatman, that sustains and manifests this universe. By identifying ourselves with the physical body, we know that we are born of the physical universe and part of nature. But when we recognize the spiritual self, when we get that first taste of the spiritual self, We know from that experience that we don't belong to this physical universe, but to the Supreme Spirit that holds this universe. That spiritual self is not in nature and not subject to physical laws. It's pure, immortal spirit. It's freedom itself. It belongs to God and God alone. Christ says, "The wind bloweth where it pleases. You hear its sound, but you cannot tell where it comes from or where it is going. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit," with a capital S. He's describing the state of liberation. Spiritual rebirth gives us the impetus and the potency that takes us eventually to the state where we become established in spiritual life, in peace, in blessedness, and in that unspeakable freedom and joy.